So this is the fourth Kabbalah class. And again, I hope to remember to point out every week that this is in the year of Hakeil, the year where there's special energy for getting together in groups for inspiration. Today is a special day to have this class for some other reasons, in addition to the fact that this class is given in memory of my father, Olav Shalom. Today is the 14th day of Kislev, and there's two weddings I'd like to talk about just for a very, very brief moment. One happened many years ago, when our Rebbe married the daughter of the previous Rebbe in Warsaw. And the Rebbe, being a descendant of the Tzemach Tzedek, of the third Rebbe, and of course his the one who became his wife, is also descendant from the same family going through the lines of the Rebbes. By getting married, a man who was otherwise completely insistent on making his persona hidden, as many people have related on video way before he was Rebbe, he would try not to tell people his last name, Schneerson, since that was a name of high repute. So through this wedding, he became the Rebbe, and Chassidim were connected through him. He's connected to us. He did everything he did for the world. This day is very significant in that respect. This day is extremely significant for another reason also, because today, earlier today, this is Israel time, I will say last night Israel time, there was a wedding that you... There's a wedding of... you may remember some time ago there was a family who were on the way to the Shabbos Ofruf before a wedding, parents of a Kala in Israel, and they were shot. They were driving to where their daughter was going to be married later on that week. We were going to have a Kiddush on Shabbos called the Ofruf.
They were coming from the Green Zone.
Wherever they were coming from. So the father of the Kala was shot, and a sister got killed, and a sister got killed, the others got wounded. So anyway, the wedding was last night. Now, we're going to hear some very, very special things about this from Simi tonight in Inspiration in 10 at 7:30. So you really want to make a point of tuning in tonight. It's on the signature of all of our emails and also on our homepage, c4j.ca. So now, to come to where we're up to, we started the first class of Kabbalah, and we gave an introduction by tasting. We then, the next 2 weeks, we started on a journey of history. We first started with the Sefer Yetzirah, and last week we went, we touched upon the prophecy of Yechezkel, and also connected some things in it, Rotzav Eshov, reaching and retreating, to different ideas, so that we have some idea of Kabbalah and also how it relates to our lives, and I tried to connect it with the historical piece also. We're going to do that today as well. And today, I'd like to begin with a question, which it's unlikely that we will answer it today. Probably it will take either 2 or 3 weeks to get to the answer. There is a verse, there's actually a concept that's stated multiple times, but there is a verse that we recite several times a day in Aleinu, 3 times a day in Aleinu, and we say, Ein od milvado. There is nothing beside him, capital H, meaning there's nothing besides God. If there is nothing beside God, how could it be that we exist? And if the Torah is true, which obviously it is, because it's God's wisdom, and the entire Jewish people witnessed God's presence, seeing and hearing the utterance of the Ten Commandments, so therefore, when the Torah says that God created the world and everything that's in it, so God is telling us that this world is not an illusion, which in some other disciplines, let's say, they would like to suggest that, but we maintain that God has told us that this world does exist. How can this world exist if there is nothing else besides God? Now, obviously, there is an answer, but it's important to be bothered by the question, because being bothered by the question and then finding relief in the answer will illuminate, as long as we care to pay attention to this point, all of our lives. And that is, B'li Neder, that's a commitment that I'm making, not based on me, obviously, but based on the teachings of the mystical teachings, that this is how it's going to be. Now, in order to continue in the introduction of Kabbalah, I need to take one specific point and dwell on it a little bit. And that is as follows. There is an expression in the Tanakh on a number of occasions, but I'll mention one incident because this became a proverb in probably most languages. And this is where the prophet Shmuel meets Shaul through a whole set of circumstances. And he says to him, you're going to go in such and such a direction, you're going to meet B'nai Hanavim. Now the literal translation of B'nai Hanavim means the sons of the prophets, but that's not what it means. Because when we say, Va'ata ben Adam, and you the son of man, we mean that you, mortal. So obviously you're the son of man, you're a descendant of the first Adam, but we mean who you are. So B'nai Hanavim, we mean the group of prophets. And he says to Shaul that you're going to meet them and you will prophesy along with them, which happens, and they blurt out, Hagam Shaul Banavim, is Saul also among the prophets? And that became a phrase or an aphorism, I don't know if that was aphorism the right word, but it's in most languages it's there. My point for raising this is, who are these B'nai Hanavim, with these groups of prophets? Especially, as I said, that it's mentioned many other times in various narratives about groups of prophets. The prophet Ovadia, when Isabel wanted to slaughter all the prophets, took 100 of them and hid 50 in one cave and 50 in the other, and he would bring them food, make sure that they got food. Well, we don't even have 100 prophets named that we know. As far as I recall, it's 57, I think, of which there's maybe not 57, 50, I think it's 57, and a number of them are women, and many of them, or most of them, are men, but that's less than 100. So the truth is, anyone who studies the Talmud knows that the only prophets we know about are those whose message was not only for the moment, but was for eternity. But the Talmud tells us that during a little more than a millennia, where prophecy, and I use this word carefully, was commonplace, there were approximately 600,000 men who reached the level of prophecy and approximately 600,000 women who reached the level of prophecy. So in other words, the fact that Devorah is known as a prophetess, or Miriam, is on a certain level not a big deal, because there were many women on the level of prophecy. What was a big deal about them was that they had a message for eternity. And that's why it's recorded. Now, after the destruction of the first temple, prophecy was less common, which is why the Talmud tells us that the era of prophecy ended. It doesn't mean that there will not be any more prophecy thereafter, because about 850 years ago, the Rambam wrote the Yad HaChazaka, the 14 books which encompass all of Yiddishkeit. And in it, he tells us, and we're going to read part of it, but I'd like you to take this handout with you so you can read the whole thing. And I would urge you to read the whole thing, not right now, but we're going to read certain parts of it. And he tells us, as a continuation of how a Jewish person thinks, and an introduction, or a preceding, how a regular Jewish person would behave, he tells us what a person can do, and guaranteed to reach the level of prophecy. And therefore, I'd like to read, even though I know you can all read, but it's important for these words to be articulated. And it's Halacha 1. So when it says Halacha 1, Halacha means the Rambam is not writing this as a book of mysticism. He's writing this as Jewish law. Law means there's no other way. This is the way. Halacha means this is the path. That's it. Now, before we continue, let me explain at this point, why am I interjecting this piece about prophecy? Because if we're going to go down the history of prophecy, which we are, we're going to discover that certain teachings of the Kabbalah were revealed at different times in history. So how come certain ideas were not revealed previously? And what I would like to do is to connect this with what we're going to learn about prophecy, because what we're going to find out is that unlike, for example, law in the Talmud, where law has to be proven through argument and debate an analysis, Kabbalah is completely different, as in the word Kabbalah itself. What does the word Kabbalah mean? It does not mean mysticism or mystery. The closest to that, that's right, the closest to that is in that word paradise on the top, the fourth letter, sod, which means secret, because it was held secret for most of our history. Kabbalah means received. In English, in this context, we mean tradition. Now, tradition not, oh, it's traditional to, I don't know, to have a latkes on Hanukkah, which is, it is traditional. What I mean is tradition that this is a complete body of knowledge that's passed down from generation to generation. And at various points in that transmission, in that Kabbalah, people, holy people, through reaching levels of the Holy Spirit, what we call Ruach HaKodesh, which is something that in the middle column, the last few words in the English in the middle column, which in Hebrew is Ruach HaKodesh, says after these preparations, the Divine Spirit will immediately rest upon him. So this is where we get a progression in teachings of Kabbalah, where certain questions that were heretofore not explained, such as how do we exist if there's nothing else besides God? So that question, even though it has its root in Sefer HaBohir, which we're going to talk about in just a moment, nevertheless, it was completely clarified by the Arizal, which is only 500 years ago, which in our history is pretty much last week. So, with that in mind, let's read what it says in Halacha 1. It is one of the foundations of our faith that God conveys prophecy to man. Now, I want to pause here. Why is that a foundation of our faith? Because if God does not communicate with man, who says that God wants us to do anything that we're doing? Maybe God wants us to starve ourselves to death, maybe not. Maybe he wants us to be like the jungle. How do we know? The only way life can make sense is if God communicates a purpose to man. Then he goes on to say, prophecy is bestowed only upon a very wise sage of strong character. Now, let's stop right here. In other words, in Yiddishkeit, remember how we spoke how emet, the first, middle, and last letter, which means truth, and truth has integrity into and of itself, beginning, middle, and end, complete integrity without flaw. It's not possible for a person to be involved in a spiritual experience like prophecy without having God's wisdom firmly implanted and broadly implanted in his mind and expressed in his behavior. And this is something that is unique to Judaism, meaning to say not only about prophecy, that in Judaism, when we look at how should a person be, any person, you or me, the goal is always to have integrity between learning and character, between our mind and our behavior, and everything in between. There should be complete integrity. So prophecy is bestowed only upon a very wise sage of a strong character who is never, and that word is very important, never overcome by his natural inclinations in any regard. Instead, with his mind, he overcomes his natural inclinations at all times. He must also possess a very broad and accurate mental capacity. A person who is full of these qualities and is physically sound, that is, he's fit for prophecy, when he enters the paradise, there's this word again that's on top of the page, the orchard where the multiple levels of Torah, which we spoke about in previous class, last week and 2 weeks ago. When he enters the paradise and is drawn into these great and sublime concepts, if he possesses an accurate mental capacity to comprehend and grasp them, which is why just scrolling and browsing and reading Kabbalah online and think that we know a whole ton, right? That's not how it works. He will become holy if he does all the above. He will advance and separate himself from the masses who proceed in the darkness of the time. It doesn't mean that he will live in seclusion. It means that in the way he behaves, he is distinct. He must continue and diligently train himself not to have any thoughts whatsoever about fruitless things or the vanities and intrigues of the times. So in other words, thought, speech, and action under his control at all times. Now we can pause here for a minute, because now we're getting an insight into a phenomenon that happened during that little over 1,000 years where prophecy was, quote, common, because they had yeshivas, literally yeshivas, where people studied and practiced to reach a level of prophecy. And these people were called B'nai HaNaviim. That's the people that Shaul, Saul, met when he was told by the prophet Shmuel that he would. These are the kind of prophets that the prophet Ovadia hid in the two caves. And all of the other such people that are mentioned in the Tanakh. These are people who studied and trained themselves to reach this level of spiritual perfection. So, any person is able to control his thought at all times, his speech and his action, but it's very difficult. And this subject of how does one do that, just to connect these two, is in fact the subject of the 53 chapters of the Tanya. Instead, we continue, his mind should constantly be directed upward, bound beneath God's throne of glory. Now, of course, throne of glory, as we saw in the prophecy of Yechezkel, which I mentioned briefly last week, is called Maisa Merkava, which means dealing with the chariot, the divine chariot. And I said I won't really go into why it has that name. But here he says, so part of it is God's throne. You remember last week we talked about the throne and the different faces. Striving to comprehend the holy and pure forms and gazing at the wisdom of the Holy One, blessed is He in its entirety, in its manifold manifestations. Now how can we gaze at the wisdom of the Holy One, blessed? We can't. Gaze at wisdom, you can comprehend. But then on the other hand, somebody explains something and you say, oh, I see. So the word perception, probably in all languages, I'm going to guess, but certainly in the languages that I know, clarity of thought we call seeing. And the same thing is definitely true in Hebrew. The very first of the 10 sefirot, something that we'll probably get to today, is called chochma, which is called sight, the very first level of intellect. So to comprehend the holy and pure forms, and gazing at the wisdom of the Holy One, blessed is He in its entirety, in its manifestations, from the most elevated spiritual form until the navel of the earth, which is, of course, an expression which in Hebrew works very well. Ad tabur ha'aretz, in English we don't really say that, but we mean right to the core. In other words, that ladder bridging heaven and earth in last week's parasha, we spoke about it last week as well, he understands all of it and everything in between. Appreciating his greatness from them. After these preparations, the divine spirit will immediately rest upon him. And we'll go only a little bit further. When the spirit rests on him, his soul becomes intermingled with angels called Ishim. Different kinds of angels. Ishim actually means men, because others were called animals, if you remember, or wild animals, which we spoke about last week, why they had that name. And he will be transformed into a different person, who will understand with a knowledge different from what it was previously. He will rise above the level of other wise men. As the prophet Shmuel told Shaul, remember we mentioned this just a moment ago, the Spirit of God will descend upon you and you shall prophesy with them and you will be transformed into a different person. We're going to end here and the rest you can read on your own time because we're going to move ahead here. Now, I want to take this vein and give a couple of examples of people who had this type of experience because there's a story that I've told here many, many times, and it's not the most dramatic supernatural story on the surface, but I repeat it for a reason. I'm going to repeat it here. So a woman that Simeon and I know used to live somewhere in the Lower Mainland and had whatever issues, and she went to the Rebbe for dollars and said, I have such and such a whatever the issue was. And the Rebbe said, check your mezuzahs. So she went and he checked her mezuzahs, which meant when she came back she would send them away to a sofer, and they were all good. So 6 months later she came back to New York, went for dollars to the Rebbe and said, I have such and such a problem. The Rebbe said, check your mezuzahs. She says, I did, and they're all okay. And the Rebbe said one word, impossible. Now, how does any person 3,000 miles away say something like that with such certainty? How is that possible? So let's remember what we... And of course, the end of the story is that she realized that there's something she's missing. And she found that was one of the doors that was overlooked. And I say this even though I've said it before, and it's good for all of us to hear it, and for those listening to the recording. This can happen to anybody. Because we lived here for a few years, and then I realized that there was a certain door, the backside of the shed, that we never ever used, so I therefore never even thought about it. And for a long, long time, I never had a mezuzah. And then I realized, years after that, that in the crawl space where you're crawling between the beams, that some of the beams are made specifically wider than the regular 18 inches to be a doorway, even though you have to crouch to get through. So those require a mezuzah. So, coming back to the story, how does a person even pretend to know, let alone with certainty, what's happening? And this, as I said, is a minor story, not saying about somebody got sick or whatever, something like that. So how does that happen? So here's another story that goes back 500 years ago, which is, again, after the lifetime of the Rambam. But this is well known over the entire world, that the one who codified the Jewish law, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who lived in Tzfas, same time as the Arizal, I believe they davened in the same shul. And he himself tells a story how one Shavuos night he was learning with great intensity, and the description would fit into sort of this description here, and how what he calls a Magid Meshorim, a spiritual entity, I'm going to say an angel, he doesn't use that word, appeared to him and taught him Torah. And he wrote a book which is published and available today called Magid Meshorim. So even though his main work is all legal, is actually his main three works are legal, the Kesef Mishneh, the Beis Yosef, and the Shulchan Aruch are all legal. This work is completely coming straight from the spiritual world. And this is what the Rambam says, that a person who lives this way, that assert that this spirit is going to descend on him. Now, I'd like us to open up the Siddur for a moment, to page 149, where we put the bookmarks. That's an annotated Siddur of Kohos. And then we're going to close it because we're going to come back to it. And I'd just like to show you one word. The one word I'd like to talk about now is in Hebrew, it's Posach or Patach, which in English it says, Elijah opened his discourse. The word is opened, or he opened, if you want to make it an independent thought. What is the meaning he opened? So I come back to a story that happened with Rabbi Yosef Karo in Tzfas, with the Magid Meshorim, with this, I'll call it, angel, who taught him the secrets of the Torah. He was once sitting in shul, and he was toiling away at a certain difficult piece in the Talmud somewhere, whatever the issue was. And after a long time of tremendous concentration, now we're talking about one of the most significant contributors to Jewish life in all of history, that for the last 500 years, we all have been, every Jewish person walking this planet, in the Jewish behaviors is practiced by his writings, is influenced by his writings, until finally he figured it out. And then he's sitting there, and somebody else comes into shul and opens up a Talmud, and he begins studying the same piece. And right away, without even analyzing it, he immediately, because the way we study is not like in a public library where everything's so quiet, you just whisper or use your eyes. But in Yiddishkeit, the preferred method is to verbalize what you study, one of the reasons being actually a Kabbalistic one, which is to take God's wisdom and to elevate the very air of this world by articulating God's wisdom as we study it. And as he's studying aloud, as I said, which is the way we've always done it, he says it the way that the Rabbi Yosef Karo had spent so much time on, and this, whoever it was, came in and just said it like that to begin with. And he was very troubled by this. And he asked the Magid Meshorim, and this is where the story is told in that book. And he asked this, again, I'll use the word angel. How come? And the angel explained to him that there are certain divine energies that the first time they come down to this world, it takes a tremendous breakthrough. It's not a simple thing for a new divine revelation to reach this earth. So that concept in Torah teaching that you had, it took a tremendous breakthrough, which you did through your toil, all those many, many hours of intense concentration. Once the channel, the spiritual channel was opened, it made it easy for other people to come to it very easily. And this concept is rooted in the Zohar, which we're looking at a piece of Zohar on page 149. In this single word, it says, Posach Eliyahu va'omar. Elijah opened his discourse and said, now whatever he says later, we'll get to as much as we are able today. It means that Elijah the prophet broke through with a new divine revelation as discussed in this piece, which happens to discuss the 10 sefirot of the world of Atzilut, as well as alluding to things that are higher than Atzilut. But this was a breakthrough. And many times in the Zohar we have that expression that so-and-so opened and said, he opened his discourse, it meant that this was a new revelation. I'd just like to give a more modern actually seemingly secular example of this, and we've discussed this at great length on other occasions, but I'll just tell you very, very quickly that the Zohar 2,000 years ago made a prediction, and this can be found in the Zohar corresponding to the portion of Noah, where it says that when Noah was 600 years old, that's when the windows of the heaven opened up and it rained down into the earth, and that the Niftchua Arubis HaShemayim, that's the windows of the heaven, the expression used in the Torah, about Umayanot Tohom Rabbah, and the wellspring of the great deep swelled forth water, and the world was covered in water. So the Zohar says on that, that in the sixth century of the sixth millennia to creation, which corresponds to the century of 1740 to 1840 in our calendar, that there's going to be an opening of, the Zohar says, of the upper wisdoms, which means wisdoms of spiritual wisdoms, such as we're studying at this very moment. And there's also going to be a groundswell of the knowledge of the world, which we call science these days, which will converge to hasten the coming of the final redemption. So without getting too much into that particular piece, basically what happened was that in that century, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, somebody had an idea that was in front of everybody's face from the beginning of time. And that is, anytime somebody wanted to cook water, they discovered if they put a lid on it, the water would boil quicker. And when the water boiled, the steam would push up the lid, maybe it would whistle. So everybody, except for maybe the first person who never put a lid on, whoever boiled water knew that there is energy in steam. And there used to be a few inventions over the passage of time, gunpowder, the printing press, but it was hundreds of years between inventions, the wheel, battering ram, catapult. But one day somebody woke up and said, well, wait a second, right in front of our face, there's this energy, we can harness the energy of steam. And he created the steam engine. And there was therefore invented a train called the rocket, and that could travel at a whopping 14 miles per hour. And at the same time, they also invention of the spinning wheel. Wow. With that came industrialization, urbanization, and the inventions are just coming so quick that we know that by the time we buy something, already on the drawing board it's already obsolete. And many years ago I heard it said that most of the things we will use in 5 years from now have not been invented, and I sort of wondered about that, but I think it's true. I remember that the other week I couldn't remember the name of the Palm Pilot. Right, the Palm Pilot revolutionized the world, if you remember. And here, it was so antiquated now, I couldn't even remember it. I only used one for many years. You know what I mean? It was. So I'm just saying. Now, what happened here? That there's a certain divine energy that the Almighty was not going to release to the world, even in the form of secular energy, of secular knowledge. People had it right in front of their face. I mean, I'll give you another example. We all know about, in factories, you have like a conveyor belt. You have conveyor belts, and you have such a chains that move things along a production line. When did that get invented? Well, once upon a time, when they were making cars, and they used to bend down to make all these pieces of equipment, so Henry Ford had this idea. He said, you know, we've all been seeing something and not seeing it. We've been seeing this thing called the bicycle chain. Let's make a big bicycle chain on a very strong table, and we'll have a production line to produce cars. And that's how production lines will form. My point is that something could be in front of your face and you don't see it. So this is a very real example in the history of the world, how there's a divine energy predicted accurately 2,000 years ago, but it was not time. And what was the spiritual opening of the windows of the heavens? Of course, at that time, was the teachings of Hasidut, which as we go through the history of Kabbalah. As a matter of fact, there were some people who called the Baal Shem Tov's teachings Kabbalat HaBaal Shem Tov, the Kabbalah of the Baal Shem Tov, instead of using the word Hasidut. He was born in 1698, just to give you an idea. And I believe he was 38, maybe I'm wrong, maybe 36, when he first started teaching, or when he first started being teaching the teachings of Hasidut. And then, of course, it spread. 90% of European Jewry, Eastern European Jewry, I should say, became Hasidim. And now, of course, it converges, because if we can send an email or Skype as we are learning these teachings, so they converge together to prepare the world for Mashiach. So all of this is to explain the word Pasach. Now, why do I have to go through such length? Because I said this before, that let's now go to this page which says the Bahir. One page you have, the Bahir, put it on top of your pile. And we're going to mention some things. Because we're going to talk about the Bahir a little, and we're going to talk about the Zohar. And now we can understand why, even though there were mystical teachings, and I use the word mystical just because that's the vernacular, but Kabbalah was around, as we already mentioned in the previous classes, for a long time. Certain ideas only came up at certain times in history, and I showed how in the Zohar, anytime it says the word Patach or Posach, it means exactly that, that a new idea was being broken forth. And that's why when we get to the Kabbalah of the Arizal, it is only through the Kabbalah of the Arizal that we can answer the question, how is it that we exist if God, if there's nothing else besides God? And it is rooted in this book, the Bahir. What is the book, the Bahir? It's really around the same time as the Zohar. The book of the Sefer HaBahir is a very small book, and it's all of about 1,200 words.
Correction, the Sefer HaBahir is 12,000 words. Please remember this correction for the next few times that I erroneously say 1,200.
Very cryptically written. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, meaning to say two generations after the Rambam, whose work we just read, Nachmanides, who was the first to incorporate into a regular commentary on the Chumash many, many teachings of Kabbalah, he said that this was authored by the person who begins the very first, says Rabbi Nechuni ben Akonisad. I mean, his name does not appear later on, other than some say perhaps in a certain allusions. Rabbi Nechuni ben Akonisad said that this is from Rabbi Nechuni ben Akonisad, and this also manuscript that was passed down just very clandestinely from one to the next to the next. And we are talking, of course, about a text that not only was accepted by the Jewish people, but until the publication of the Zohar in the 13th century, this was the most important, the most important Kabbalistic text. In other words, even though Sefer Yetzirah, which is precedes it, obviously coming from Avraham Avinu, but the Sefer HaBahir, with all of its smallness, but the certain teachings in it that were really foundational. So let us go to item number 2. I'm sorry, we'll do number 1 just a little bit. So Rabbi Nechuni ben Hakone said, now Rabbi Nechuni ben Hakone, just to say something about him, I mean, he's in the Talmud many, many times, but there's a very beautiful prayer, Ono Bechoach. I don't know how to say it in English, right?
Well, yeah,
and it's so moving, it's unbelievable. I mentioned this actually 2 weeks ago, I think.
Yeah.
One of the names of God is called Shem Ma, of 45 letters, and I explained that if you spell God's name with the Aleph, the way it's spelled, Yud, Vav, Aleph, Vav, the numeric value is 45. So there are 45 letters arranged as one in that express the divine energy of that name. And that is known, that was known for many, many years. I'm going to ask you all to open up your Siddur to page 149. And then, from there, go forward, don't move the bookmark, go forward to page 157. So, it says here, when reciting Ono Bechoach, look at the divine, you're not supposed to verbalize, or visualize, the divine names formed by the acronyms of the word as they appear in the left column, but do not say them. So, what came first? Not the words. The acronyms were there way before, but Rabbi Nechuni ben Hakone, we're talking about the time of the Mishnah, approximate time of Rabbi Shimei Choy, he composed these words to fit into the divine names. So here's another area where ancient Kabbalah enters into the Siddur, and it's, we said various occasions in every Siddur, and these six lines, just to talk about them for a second, they correspond to the six midot, other than the last line, which is sort of an addition, a wrap-up later, seven lines. The seven lines correspond to the seven emotions, And each line focuses on one emotion in particular, which is in itself a whole fascinating study. I cannot tell you how many hours upon hours I have personally pondered the very thing that I have just told you. So now let's close the Siddur again and go back to the Bahir. So this small little book says in number 2, Rabbi Barachia said, again, somebody from the time of the Talmud, it is written, I'm saying it in the Hebrew first, the earth was chaos and desolation. What is the meaning of the word was in the verse? This indicates that the chaos existed previously and already was. What is chaos? That is tohu, something that confounds people. What is desolation? Bohu, something that has substance. The reason it is called bohu is bohu. Two words in Hebrew. Bo means in it, who it is. It is in it. In other words, there's some substance to it. What I would like to say to you, and I mentioned this yesterday's class, the Torah portion of Ayetzah, year 4 of our parsha class, and we had a short explanation about tohu and tikkun. Tohu, chaos, which came down to this earth in the form of somebody called Esav, the twin brother of Yaakov. And Tikkun, which means reparation, which came down to this world in the form of Yaakov. And the reason why they were born as twins and struggled even from the womb represents the struggle between Tohu and Tikkun. And I said yesterday that it's something that further down the line, not to date, we're going to be studying in this Kabbalah class exactly what is it all about. But I'm showing you that it's rooted right here in the first page of the Sefer HaBahir. So we have two great minds with the same question. How could we say was if the world hasn't existed yet? So we have to go back to a certain axiom, which we're going to expand on anyway today. We may as well mention it now. And I said that whenever we talk about higher, we mean deeper, more inward. So whenever we say past in time, and we are talking about beyond the world of time and space, so therefore was cannot be in time and space, it means higher or deeper. In fact, it means closer to the divine, closer to the Almighty, right? And that is something that we're going to start today, and we're going to keep on going, which will help us understand how do we exist if there is nothing else besides God. Yes. One of the things about speaking about things that are beyond time and space, using language is confined pretty much, I won't say exclusively, but pretty much confined to the imagery of time and space. So therefore, whenever you're speaking about ideas, Kabbalistic ideas that are beyond time and space, you're going to have to choose words that can only do so much justice. And that is why one must begin such a study with the initiated, not on one's own, because then we go off the track and say that it means something else. A very simple example of this would be right in the Chumash itself. It says, "Bereishis bara Elokim." In the beginning, God created. Actually, you could say that that's not a correct translation. In the beginning of God's creation, I should say, as Rashi says. But Elohim is plural. How can you have a Torah which believes that there's only one God, talk about God all the time in the plural? But that's because we need to express a point which in Kabbalah is just through and through with this point, and we're going to be going through it not now, that you have to use that word to express what you mean to express. So in other words, you can say, why can't you say what you mean? And the short answer is language is limited. So you have to take words, the best word you can choose, and use it, and then give a whole explanation to try and convey what you mean beyond the word itself. Like using the word sparks, we had the same discussion yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. Why use the word light, which we spoke also, I think, in one of the previous Kabbalah classes. So we're going to now put aside the Sefer HaBahir, and we're now going to talk about the Zohar, and then we're going to open the Siddur and study some of the Zohar. Now, some of the history of the Zohar. I mentioned something in the very first class very briefly, and I'm just going to re-mention it very briefly, that on our website, c4j.ca, that's the letter C, the number 4, the letter J.ca, you'll find one of the yellow buttons on the menu bar says Kabbalah. If you click on it, you can find, and it'll take a while to find it, an article by Rabbi Chaim Miller in which he disproves that which was written by Gershon Scholem, the professor, and others regarding the origins of the Zohar. It's not short, but it's not too difficult to follow either. And he simply goes to demonstrate that the various things they say about the origins of the Zohar simply comes from abysmal scholarship, which he demonstrates every substantiation of what I've just said. And I'm saying this because the Zohar was obscure for so many years and came to the fore in the 13th century. What happened in between? So I'd just like to say very briefly that there are certain parts of the Zohar which it's pretty certain that they were written by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai himself. Other parts of the Zohar were transcribed by a student of his, Rabbi Abba, and it's very possible that there were some others who transcribed other parts. Now, some of these teachings have been lost over time, which is why the Zohar only covers certain parts. If you buy a set of the Zohar, it basically has five volumes. The first three volumes have been organized according to the Torah portions of the week, meaning say they were not originally delivered in that manner, but they were arranged to be studied in that manner. But I believe it comes, when it comes to, if I recall correctly, the Torah portion of Pinchas, it stops, and there's a couple of bits and pieces from later parashas, so giving us the indication that there is things that are missing. We also have certain manuscripts that were discovered later, and therefore they are called, one is called Tikkuni Zohar, which is what the piece that we're going to take a look in the Siddur, that's where it comes from Tikkuni Zohar. And there's the fifth volume, which is called Zohar HaChadash, the new Zohar. It means the most recent discovery, which was however many centuries ago. And just to say very briefly that the Jewish people, we know how to be a very argumentative people, and for a very good reason. Because we are taught not to accept only because so-and-so said, and as you've heard me say countless times over the years, that there's two words that every serious student of Judaism has to live with. Who can convince me? And the entire Talmud is based on those two words. Convince me. You say that such and such is the ruling. Convince me. And if there's enough debate, and it's not, and the argument is not convincing, it's actually rejected. Which happens not only in the Talmud, but throughout Jewish scholarship. Therefore, when the entirety of the Jewish people, or the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people, even in face of scholarly opposition, accept something, that means that an argumentative people are accepting something, it has to be pretty convincing. So for example, when certain people in Israel would like to rediscover the source of the blue Tehillet for Tzitzit, the world of Jewish scholarship has not even paid attention to it, even though you can buy them in the store, which I recommend against on halakhic grounds, which is another whole discussion, because if you're wrong about the color of Tehillet, then you render your Tzitzit invalid, actually, which is another whole discussion. But my point is, the reason that I know that they could not be right is because the arguments didn't convince any of the great minds of the Jewish people. And for something that's a biblical commandment, which we repeat at least twice a day, that's a very loud statement. However, when the Jewish people accept the Zohar as being the teachings of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, then that's a very firm statement that that is what it is.
But you know,
given that as a basic outline of the Zohar, let us now open the Siddur. And the reason why we're opening the Siddur, because in our Siddur, the custom is to recite this on Friday afternoon. I believe, I could be incorrect, I believe this began with the Baal Shem Tov. But be that as it may, it gives us a piece of Tikkuni Zohar, of the Zohar, in Hebrew with vowels. Actually, it's Aramaic with vowels, I should say, and with English translation. And we're going to go through some of it, and we're going to, of necessity, continue more next week, even though we want to go a little bit further in the history Rav Moshe Padavero, and then the Arizal, and then what Chassidus added to all that. So we already explained the first word, Patach Eliyahu, that Eliyahu broke forth his spiritual channel to give his teachings, which means, how come the people before him didn't have it? We just understood why. Why should we accept it from him, or from anyone else in the Zohar where it says that he opened up this channel? Because as we saw in Maimonides, that if a person who trains themselves, as the Rambam describes, the Rambam says, as a matter of Jewish law, meaning as Jewish fact, the Divine Spirit will rest on him, and he will therefore have access to spiritual information that was heretofore unknown. And I got to tell this story just very quickly, because Ariel Sharon, he came to visit the Rebbe, and when he came to the United States, he came right out of top secret meeting, which was debating what was called the Bar-Lev line. The Bar-Lev line was three rows of reinforcements where soldiers were dug in to protect the border of the land of Israel. And in this top secret meeting, some of the generals were saying, why should we break up our forces into three weaker? Let's make them all into one solid line of protection. So literally, coming from that meeting, flying to New York, visiting the Rebbe, and the Rebbe, without him asking, starts talking to him about the Bar-Lev line, and saying to him, and this is something that Ariel Sharon says on video, what I'm saying now, he says, I didn't think of 770 as a place of gathering information, because he couldn't figure out how in the world does the Rebbe in Brooklyn have this kind of information. So of course it's a place of, in the Rebbe's room, place of gathering information, when you're connected up above, you know, like the Rambam describes, then you get this kind of information. There's no spies in the top secret generals who are calling up the Rebbe and say, oh, listen to what we just spoke about yesterday. No such thing. And the Rebbe said to him that if we follow the Bar-Lev line, it's going to result in a great tragedy, because all three lines will be easily broken through, which is precisely what happened on the Yom Kippur War. They were broken through, boom, in no time, and there were so many tragedies. And this Ariel Sharon, as I said, he says it on the video. So why did I bring it up now? Because, again, this idea that if there's going to be a new revelation of teaching, that Arizal is going to teach us something, that when we get to it, it's going to answer the question, how can we exist if there's nothing else besides God? So this is just some more real life evidence of this, because if a chassid were to tell the story is one thing, but somebody like Ariel Sharon, who I don't think we can convince of having a fantastic yeshiva education and being raised in the most super chassidic home, but when he tells such a story, you know, you better believe it. So coming back, he says, we come back to Pasuk Eliyahu. Here we go. So Pasuk Eliyahu Amar, Eliyahu, he opened his discourse and he said, Ribon Olmin, Master of the Universe, Ant Huchod, you are one, V'loy B'chushbon, but not in the numeric sense. We spoke about the Shema last week, and we should have used the word Yachid, one and only. So that's what it says here, one and not in relationship to numbers. Let's go a little bit further. Ant hu ilo al kolilon. You are exalted above all the exalted ones. Now, on a very basic level, you could say, oh, so you have an exalted, let's say, five-star general, and above the general, you have the king. That's not what this means. On a very plain level, without even going to which mystical levels it is referring to, which is the commentaries explain, we're just going to say this. We're saying that when we say God is exalted, it's not even within the realm of exalted as humans can perceive it. Now, I want to say something, and please, I hope I'm not confusing you. I'd like you to follow with this point. Last week we spoke about how the word spiritual, in the context that I'm saying it now, really means non-physical, non-time and space. Right? Of the spirit, meaning thought. I gave that as an example. Even if a person is thinking how to rob a bank or how to lie, it's still not physical. So the same way, when we say that God is exalted above all that is exalted, we don't mean just like a mountain on top of a mountain. We mean exalted, that the way we perceive exalted, it's not even within that realm. So what is it? I don't know. You know why? Because I'm not God, and I'm not big enough to contain in my mind a perception of what God is. However, it's possible to get a little bit closer to that perception by at least clarifying what God is not. More on this point right now. Stima al kol stimin, concealed above all those things that is concealed. Which again, the concealment hidden, it's just completely different than regular what we call concealment that could be discovered, right? Concealed could be discovered. But this is just concealed. Now, is that not being repetitive? So the truth is, as the commentaries who explain this piece actually explain which part of the geography up there in the spiritual world each of these is referring to, and I don't think we're going to have time to get to that now, because it, besides everything else, the level is way beyond where we're up to now. But here, the next one is very, very important. Les machshava tvisa boch klal. No thought can grasp you at all. So you might say, well, that's easy. Not so. Next time anyone asks themselves, why is God doing this? Remember these words. Les machshava tvisa boch klal. No thought can grasp you. I mean, how many people with good schooling can really give a clear explanation of the theory of relativity? And if you think I'm making that up, I defy you. Go onto the internet, as I have done, and view as many sites as you want that begin to try and make it clear, other than the basic that we all do understand. There's a lot in there that most of us are not able to understand to the point that we can explain it. So if that is the case, and Einstein was just a mortal, what about why God does something? Or people will say, well, does God really care if I just, whatever, flick a switch on Shabbos? Or does God really care if I have a hangnail or not? Well, right there, it's not possible to grasp God with thought. So even though it's logical, but human nature attempts to defy that. And the truth of the matter is, if a person really internalize this phrase to its complete and logical conclusion, a person would not be stressed out, period.
Say that part again?
A person would not be stressed out.
Before that,
if a person could really internalize this point to its complete and logical conclusion, we would never be stressed out.
Because
if I lose my job today, and whatever my assets, the houses that I bought, are all, they burnt down, or whatever, the government stole this and that, and whatever, now I get a lawsuit of something that never happened, and on and on and on and on. How can I don't expect to understand God's ways. Now, I'm not pretending to be on that level. I don't know how many thousands of miles or light years away from that, but I'm saying that this is something that is very real that we can grow into. So, yes. So the question is very significant that we just heard. We're being told to love God and to be in awe of God, to have a relationship with God. How can we have a relationship with an entity, I'll use that word, which I don't have another word for, that we cannot grasp? So I think the way to explain it is, when we are children, we know that we have a relationship with our parents. But only when we become much older ourselves do we begin to understand the meaning of that kind of a relationship. In other words, a relationship is not an intellectual exercise. Because here when it says no thought can grasp you, it's referring to thought of intellectual comprehension. But it's possible to have a relationship with someone to the even though I have no clue how that entity, the one I love, how much they love me in return. It is very possible that they love me more than I love them, which is probably, if we could analyze, let's say, in any couple. I don't know that we would find them to be exactly parallel, and in some cases there would be a great distinction. But now, let's say the following. The Jewish people come to Mount Sinai. And what happens? This God that we cannot perceive gives them a communication where they hear and see God. And then God says to them, I want you to have a loving relationship with me. And God also says that I love you. You can't compare God's attachment to us, but the what God has told us is that we should have a relationship to Him. Now we need to add one more point. At the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, something which was in potential in last week's class and in last week's parasha, the ladder in Yaakov's dream, connecting, being firmly implanted on the ground and reaching to the heights of the heaven, came to reality. Meaning to say, how could the spiritual and the physical interconnect? Physical is physical, spiritual is spiritual. But seeing that the Almighty is not limited by the confines of material and spiritual, and He can actually cause there to be supernatural occurrences within this world, such as the existence of the Jews and many other such examples, our influence on the world, and many other such examples which we've discussed numerous times, that all began at the connection of Mount Sinai, which means to say, the communication of Mount Sinai was, of course, a supernatural event, but it began where God says, even though you don't know who I am, but you know that I am. As a matter of fact, a few chapters before, the Maimonides, piece of Maimonides that we read here, Maimonides makes it very clear that it's not that we believe God in God because of rational arguments, which we could discuss. And for those who would like to, in the Shaar Yichud V'Emunah of the Chovat HaLevavot, duties of the heart, in the English translation, I believe it's either volume one of them, that has a whole piece called The Gate of Unity and Faith, in which he goes through, I believe, 15 logical examples proving that there is a God. He actually considers it to be a biblical commandment to go through such an intellectual exercise. The Rambam says that that's not why we accept the Torah as true. We accept the Torah as true because God spoke to us as an enormous public at Mount Sinai. Meaning to say that God says, you don't know who I am, but I love you and I want you to be in love with me. And I say those words that way on purpose, and also to be in awe of me. So yes, will we ever have an intellectual comprehension of God? Never. We can remove those things that He is not, but we can have a relationship to the extent that we can. One second. Just to add to what you said, in Tanya, he speaks about this many times, and he says we cannot grasp God intellectually, of course, we cannot, but we can grasp God's desire when we fulfill it. Just think about it for a second. Let's say a person is like the scholar of the millennia, like Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, right? The Time magazine called him a once-in-a-millennia scholar, right? So he's sitting there with, I don't know, a stack of books, deep in thought, ready 4 hours, and some vagabond strolls in, and he just sees him, he says, could you do me a favor? Could you turn on the other light? Whatever the intellectual capacity and difference between them is, there's a connection. Because now, this person who just strolled in, maybe hasn't bathed in a couple of weeks, and hasn't taken a haircut in a few years, but they connected because he did what this individual wanted. And that's precisely what happens with the mitzvot, and this is in the fourth chapter of Tanya, that we cannot grasp God, but we can grasp His desire, and when we get to learn the Sefirot, we're going to learn how desire, which is rooted in Keter, is even higher than the Sefirot. We can grasp God's desire when we perform His mitzvot. Now, if you just think about that for a second, remember I gave in the first week the example of holding a Kiddush cup and understanding that it parallels something in the spiritual world. But now all of a sudden, if we can understand what this level of Keter is, it's actually going to be discussed here in the Zohar. If we can understand what that is, and we can understand that that's what a mitzvah is, and we can put our headspace into that when we do a mitzvah. You see how all of a sudden, learning this esoteric teaching, and we can actually bring it down in having the relationship with God. Yes. So one of the things that happens in prayer, when we talk about God's creation, so, and we can read beneath just the words themselves, and we can understand some of the divine energy behind it, by understanding God's greatness, we feel such humility. That's the sense of awe. And that is, in fact, what we're told to do before prayer. It's even in the Code of Jewish Law. And that is to ponder God's greatness, which is why in the approach of Chassidus Chabad, if a person who wants to pray with a certain intense devotion, they would first study a tract of Chassidut, to ponder teachings such as we're doing here, because it puts a person into such a state of humility, but there's also a sense of gratefulness to be able to have a relationship with an Almighty who is just so beyond.
The letter.
So the first letter Aleph. Tell you very quickly the story how this came about. So the Alter Rebbe went over to a certain individual and he said to him, "I have a mitzvah of teaching my son Torah." That is the one who would then become the second Rebbe. "You have a mitzvah of giving sustenance to your family. Let us make a switch. I will give you sustenance for your family and you'll teach my son." He was a little kid, maybe 3 years old at the time. So he was a wise fellow. That's how the Rebbe phrased it, not in English. And he said, "If I'm going to teach your son Aleph Beis, I need to know how to teach him Aleph Beis." So obviously it doesn't mean that he didn't know how to read. So the Alter Rebbe understood what he was saying, and the Alter Rebbe said to him, "If you take a look at the shape of a letter Aleph, you have a point above and a point below and a line in between. The point above represents the point of divinity or the point of Torah. The point below represents the godly soul that's in a body in this world." No, the point above is not Torah, sorry. "And the line in between is the line that connects, I mean that bar that runs in between, is the one that connects the two dots." And there's either it's two versions or he said both of them, I don't recall. "A line of Yiras Shemayim, being in awe of God, is how the lower point connects with the higher point. And Torah study is how the lower point connects with the higher point." Yes?